It is a custom to portray the last 10, 12 years as the decade of peace negotiations, a great advance in the history of Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then to show the outbreak of the Intifada, first the collapse of the Camp David talks and then the outbreak of the second Intifada in September 2000, as a break, as a very tragic, almost ununderstandable break with this, within this course of progressive course of peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. I would like here, first of all, to describe the results of what was happening on the ground in the occupied territories, in the territories occupied by Israel in 67, without any relation to the negotiation itself. I would like to give you now to sort of a picture, moving picture, of the population, the Palestinian population, moving picture of geography and residency. Or actually, I could term it as a description of the accessibility of people to space and time as determined by Israel and as a demarcation line between two ethnic groups, the Jews and the Palestinians. This is a portrait, a different portrait of the last 10, 12 years, otherwise known as the decade of peace. In the last 12 years, 13 years, starting with 91, going on with 92, 93, when the Oslo process started, a final infrastructure was crystallized in our country, an infrastructure of one state in our country between the river and the sea, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. This infrastructure, physical infrastructure, is well seen now today by a very developed network of roads to the north and to the south, from the west to the east, which connect east and west and north and south of the state of Israel, and which started, the construction of which started in the beginning of the last decade of the last century, 91, 92. It had plans before already in the 80s, but the actual construction started and was accelerated during the last decade. This network of roads unite Israeli Jewish communities in the north and the south, the west and the east, connect them one to the other, makes the distance between them much shorter than the real physical distance. It shortens the time, makes them closer, and blurs the green line. You could go through this. Network of roads, and you don't know if you have passed the green line, which is the border of 67, of before 67. You don't know if you have crossed it. You don't know if you did, or if you didn't. Then this grid of very developed roads, huge roads, very comfortable roads. Every half a year, I see that they are being upgraded. Good signs, very clear signs of Israeli village, of Israeli communities. You can always find in these roads. You cannot find very clear signs of Palestinian communities. You can find signs about Israeli communities, which have grown and expanded during those last 12 years. Grown and expanded. Maybe not many new ones were established. The United States made it clear that it does not allow Israel to have new settlements, but there was a solution for this, because many settlements had all of a sudden new neighborhoods far away from the core, from the center of the old settlement, and then Of course, these new neighborhoods had to be connected to the center by another, yet another grid of inside roads, of more infrastructure, of more sewage system, more water pipes, etc. Because the infrastructure that I'm talking about is not only the physical infrastructure of asphalt and street lights. It is the infrastructure of electricity, of water, of sewage, of education, of health system, of judicial system, of taxation, of welfare, exempt of taxation, politics. This is one Israel. There is one state in the one country between the river and the sea. And this has been established and crystallized in the last 13 years. This is Upper Israel, you can call it. It is upper in terms of quality and in terms of topography. It is upper because it is a very high quality infrastructure, one which was not developed for Palestinians. The roads were not built in order to serve Palestinians who live in the occupied territories. It is meant to serve Israeli Jews. It goes in between Palestinian villages. It separates villages from main cities. It separates villages from their own land. So it is Upper Israel in the sense of the quality, of the roads, of the electricity, of water. You have all Israeli settlements are connected to the water system, to the water, the Israeli water system. Even those new unauthorized settlements, outposts, are immediately connected to some sort of Israeli supply of water. It is upper in terms of topography. The settlements are high on the ridges, on the top of the ridges, mountain ridges. The roads are high. There are bridges for Israelis. And down below, in between this developed grid of Israeli infrastructure, of the one Israeli state between the river and the sea, in between you have locked in Palestinian settlements, Palestinian communities, Palestinian villages, Palestinian cities. They are confined in between. They cannot expand, they cannot develop, because this grid already determines their scope of development. So the grid of Israeli infrastructure determines the scope and the limitations already, inbuilt limitations, of the Palestinian development. These enclaves, inbuilt enclaves, were in the last 10 years or so, were thought to be the self-rule areas of the Palestinian people, the autonomous area. But the physical existence by itself of Israeli settlements and Israeli roads, that is the one thing that determined the scope of development or non-development of these enclaves. So this, in one part, this is one of these moving, mobile photographies of the situation in our country in the last 10, 12 years, in the so-called decade of peace. The number of settlements in these Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza increased by half between 1991 and 2000. It was something like 91,000 only in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm not counting Jerusalem now. And so if we don't count East Jerusalem, it doubled from 91,000 to about 200,000 on the eve of the Intifada. If we count Jerusalem, it was about, it reached to today. Today it's 380,000, out of which 180,000 in East Jerusalem. And it was about 120,000 before, in 91. So we have So while this Israeli state grew into cover the whole country from the river to the sea, the Israeli grip of Palestinian space, this is what it means, that the Israeli grip of Palestinian space was ever more determined, ever more consolidated. Another way that was, or one of the main ways to consolidate this grip over Palestinian space was the delineation of Palestinian territory into three categories during the years of Oslo. It was called A, B, and C areas. A areas were determined as, at first it was the Palestinian cities, which were given to the Palestinian Authority to control it, to control the security inside those cities, and to control civil affairs, which means to determine who gets license to build and who gets license to have business and education affairs, etc. So it was at the beginning in 4% of the West Bank. In Gaza, it was a bit different. This was A areas. B areas were where the Palestinian Authority had both had only civil authorities, building, construction, development of some infrastructure, etc. And the rest, C areas, were Israel kept its security and civil authorities. In B areas, it had security authorities, which means Palestinian police could not be present in these areas. It was only Israeli police and Israeli army which was allowed. On the eve of the Second Intifada, 60% of the land in the West Bank were sea areas, which means 60% were areas controlled fully by Israel from a security and administrative point of view. And civil point of view, which means full control of Israel over land, not only over security, over land, development of water, agriculture, you name it. In these areas, the settlements, that's where settlements are, in this 60% of the land. More or less of this 60% of the land are called state land, which in Israel became a synonym to Jewish land, to land for Jews. So it was a custom to say, to forbid villages, during the years of Oslo, to forbid villages, for example, to develop, to build a school, to stretch a pipeline of water, because it was a sea area, and sea area is either it is under Israeli control, or it is state land. It is not land owned by the Palestinians themselves. Needless to say that at the same time, settlements were developing nearby many of those villages. So, parallel to this growing grip of Israel on Palestinian space, all of a sudden it's only 40%. And this 40% is also, it's not contiguous. It's distributed into various enclaves inside the West Bank. And in Gaza, it was 80% controlled by Palestinian Authority and 20% by Israel. But in this 20%, which are the best parts of Gaza in terms of the last remaining sources of sweet water, and the last remaining sources of land, available land, and access to the sea. So these 20% are the home of 0.5% of the Palestinian of the population in the Gaza Strip. There are now about 100,200,000 Palestinians, and there are about 6,000, let's say, or 7,000 Jews living in this 20% of the land. So again, parallel to this grip over space, we see in the last 10, 12 years, another development, another development of control over Palestinian life. And this is the control over time, over Palestinian time. This has been achieved by a new regime, new system, which we would call the PAS system. Very parallel, very similar to the one we knew in, or South Africans knew in South Africa. It is a policy which was initiated in 91, maybe before, but it was implemented in January 91. So I would like to say in advance that it was not a policy, it was not a reaction to suicide bombings in Israel, because at that time we still didn't know anything about suicide bombings in Israel. Suicide bombings started 2 years later, in 93, and then only in the West Bank and Gaza, not yet against Israeli civilians. In 94 were the first suicide bombings. So just in order to erase any misunderstandings in advance, the policy of closure, which was named closure, Seger in Hebrew, or the PAS system, was started in 91. Until 91, the Israeli authorities, occupation authorities, actually respected the right of Palestinians to freedom of movement. All Palestinians, starting with the end of the 60s or beginning of the 70s, for different reasons, Dayan believed that if the Green Line will be open for Palestinians to move and to work in Israel, they will improve their, by working in Israel, they will improve their economical situation, which was, of course, very extremely lousy. They will improve this situation and thus forget their national aspirations. This was, a colonialist illusion, self-illusion, but the borders were open and people could indeed improve their, substantially improve their economical situation, but only privately, individually. Individuals and thousands of individuals and families could improve this situation. But at the same time, Israeli authorities did not allow for development of infrastructure and development of economy inside the occupied territories. But anyway, until 91, all Palestinians were granted freedom of movement within the whole country, between the river and the sea, except some categories that were not allowed to go, to move freely. People suspicious politically, criminals or whatever, but it was not fully observed. There was no strong surveillance that did not allow those people who belonged to the wrong categories, that it prevented them from going around. They always had faced the risk of being caught, but the idea is that the entire Palestinian population, its right of freedom of movement was respected. Now, the inverse happened from 91. There was a blanket prohibition on all Palestinians to move freely, to move freely from the West Bank and Gaza to Israel, or from West Bank to Gaza and vice versa. This was a blanket prohibition, something new to most of the people, except of some categories that were allowed freedom of movement, or actually a portion of freedom of movement, as decided unilaterally by Israeli authorities. We see since 91 till today a slow progress or elaboration of this policy of a PAS system. It can take hours just to describe it. In 93, it started to incorporate East Jerusalem. Until then, East Jerusalem was the capital, almost recognized capital of Palestinians, if not political capital, but certainly economical, social, cultural, religious, health-wise. But in 93, March 93, it was Rabin by then, Palestinians were obliged to enter East Jerusalem with permits. Again, it was not easy to enforce this because East Jerusalem was not fenced then. But if caught by police, people were subject to fines or to imprisonment. Also, leaving Gaza was still possible without a permit, but people risked being caught by police. And police started ransacking known places where Palestinians used to work in Tel Aviv, or just asking anybody who looked Palestinian on the street and arresting hundreds of them in order to make clear that this new policy of a pass, of a requirement of a pass, special pass, was serious. It was not something to fool around. This policy continued with the establishment of the Palestinian Authority and the implementation of the Gaza-Jericho agreement. It meant more than ever that people could not go freely from Gaza and the West Bank. Anybody from the West Bank, forget Israel. People said, okay, forget Israel. We'll take permits to enter Israel and to work in Israel. But the connection between Gaza and the West Bank, so important for the establishment of the Palestinian Authority and the development of autonomous rule and development of all civil requirements, all this was completely curtailed parallel to the establishment of the Palestinian society. The Palestinian Authority did not acted here as a mediator. It supplied the Palestinian population with the permits. It submitted to the Israeli authorities, the civil administration, now with different names. It submitted requests of Palestinians to have such permits. So it was a postman, actually. Palestinian representatives acted as postmen. Israel could decide upon the categories and what portion of this freedom of movement each category could have. So actually what we see is that parallel to the fragmentation of Palestinian territory into these enclaves because of the Israeli grid and infrastructure, so parallel to this fragmentation, we have a fragmentation of the Palestinian society in relation to its freedom of movement. So you had workers who could go to work in Israel and stay overnight. And you had workers who could not stay overnight. And you had workers who could stay the whole week. And you had workers who could go to other places than their working place, and others who had to go only to their working place. You had merchants who could go all over with their cars, and you had merchants who could not go with their cars. So they had to have two cars, one waiting for them outside of Gaza or the West Bank. And you had sick people who could go for one day, and sick people who could go for 3 days, and sick people who had to ask for a permit every 3 days, even though they had they had to go through, let's say, chemotherapy, regular chemotherapy. And this is things that I've been monitoring for years. And you had political people who could not go at all, and you had political people who could go because they were part of Fatah or part of the Palestinian Authority, and you had people with the Palestinian Authority who could go, who had an open permit and could go with their car, but their car was checked, and then you had the other category of people who could go with their car with somebody in the car and nobody was checked. And then you had the first category of everybody who could go and come and not being checked at all, the former category, the people inside the car were checked, but not the person who had the... And you had this, innumerable set of categories of people characterized by their accessibility or non-accessibility to the privilege of freedom of movement. It's not the right of freedom of movement, because when it is taken, when this right is not given to the whole group, it becomes a privilege. And then it's only a portion of the privilege. So this was the process going on steadily, constantly, without any change, only that at times Israel could change the number, could increase the number of workers, could soften the conditions, at times curtail them. But this was a steady development, and indeed very often new regulations were introduced after suicide bombings, after attacks in Israel. Starting with 93-94, it was always the tightening of this policy, which started in 91. The tightening was shown as a reaction to attacks inside Israel. Then, in 97 was the first time that as a reaction to some suicide attacks, to three suicide attacks in Jerusalem, this was under Benjamin Netanyahu, internal closure was introduced. Internal closure which did not allow people to go from inside the West Bank between to cross Area C. So as C was still controlled, Area C was still controlled by Israel, people were not allowed to go from A to B or B to A, or A to A, etc. So this was another step of in this grip over Palestinian space. Now the need, this dependency, total dependency on Israeli pass system meant tremendous loss of time and actually loss of control over one's time. Because you wait for a permit, you don't know if you get it to go to a course in the West Bank or to go to a course abroad or to see your family. You cannot plan anything. You cannot plan because you need a permit and you don't know if you get a permit. You cannot be spontaneous because you cannot just wake up in the morning and say, okay, today I go and buy books at the bookshop in Ramallah if you live in Gaza. Or today I want to see the sunrise in the Dead Sea. Spontaneity and planning are human rights no less than other human rights. And this was completely, Palestinians were completely deprived of it during the last 13 years. So it went on and on. This policy, which very few people paid attention to it, also among Palestinians. If at all the people started to pay attention to it in 97, in 96 when Netanyahu was elected, and I think that this is, and also Israeli press started to pay attention to this, but I would say that this tells more about how the Israeli press was pro-labor than about the novelty under Netanyahu. Because in a way Netanyahu even eased, in some ways Netanyahu eased the regulations of closure, and encouraged Israeli Ministry of Labor to issue more permits of work, work permits for Palestinians inside Israel. So this policy was well exercised under the government of Rabin and then Peres. This meant this double control over Palestinian space and over Palestinian time, double Israeli control over these two important means of production for any community, any society which wants to develop, indeed meant that the whole community could not really plan physically its development. And this development, economical and social development, was taken as a backbone of any peace solution and the advance of peace. But they could not develop if they depended on Israeli decisions. When they could, for example, pave a new road, which has to go through C area, but which has to connect two Palestinian villages. If they had to wait for a permit in order to have pipeline, and then a permit for how big the size, how many inches will this pipe will be. If Palestinian officials had to wait for a permit to get out of Ramallah and to go to a meeting in Gaza, it means that the whole community and administration of this community was at a loss, all the time at a loss, all the time being hanged in the air like this. So officials as well as ordinary people. It is true indeed, and I think that this is very important to remember, that the Palestinian Authority, starting with 1993-94, did not object to this policy. When first it was, it took over, the Palestinian Authority took over the civil affairs in the Gaza Strip, it did not oppose because it fit well, the policy of closure fit well with the successful attempt of officials, Palestinian high officials, to build up economical monopolies which benefit a special nomenclatura. So under the first 3 years, 93-96, before Netanyahu, there was even sort of cooperation in the implementation of the closure policy between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli government, in the sense that there was no objection to it by the officials, and Palestinian, the entourage of Arafat and Fatah, received the very good permits, their accessibility to the freedom of movement, which was of course much better than anybody else's, which helped them in consolidating their monopolistic position. So this went on until 2000. This fragmented Palestinian society, according to its accessibility to time and to freedom of movement, was one of the reasons of growing tension between people and the authority and the elites in the Palestinian society. It was not the only reason, but it was one of the main reasons. People saw the difference. People saw that X or Y could go freely everywhere, anytime, while they were restricted to such limitations that completely suffocated them. It was translated in people's language, it was translated mostly into an economical aspects. But of course, it was not only this. I asked once people in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, who complained about the fact that they cannot go around and that they feel completely suffocated in a big prison called Gaza. I asked them, so why don't you initiate something? When Yahya Ayash was assassinated, the leader of the military wing of Hamas, when he was assassinated by Israel after he was wanted for a couple of years for his planning of terrorist attacks, of suicide bombings in Israel. When he was assassinated in January 96, some 100,000 people came to the funeral. So why can't you organize, why can't you have such a number going, having a march, peaceful march, towards one of Israel's checkpoints, demanding as a political action, demanding your right for freedom of movement, and then take your leaders, tell them to march in front of you to make sure that the Israeli soldiers will not shoot anybody, because it's people that they see all the time in their meetings. You know, it was a provocative question, but the answer was dead serious. The people told me they will never come. These leaders will never come. So there was a sort of already feeling of defeat even before anybody would think about it. I asked some others in Gaza, how come you don't voice it, that you have a right to move, you not Israel, to the West Bank? And people said, listen, if sick people do not get permits to go for treatment in Israel or in West Bank, where the treatment is a bit better, then it's luxurious for us to demand permit to go to have a hike in the desert. This was all through until 2000, until the break of this current intifada, which nobody related, of course, to this closure policy or to this fragmentation of society or the robbery, what I call the grand robbery of time. But now with this intifada, this robbery of time is even more institutionalized and has deepened immensely. Almost since the beginning of this intifada, there is a blanket prohibition on Palestinians to use the, what I told you, this roads infrastructure in the West Bank and Gaza. These roads, which were built during the last decade, on Palestinian land, separating, dividing one village from another, since, I think, sometime like November 2000, Palestinians are not allowed to use these roads. Slowly and gradually, piecemeal, since 2000, the movement restrictions have become more and more extreme. Blocks of concrete are separating villages from roads nearby or from the main roads. Mounds of land prevent also the passage from one village to another, from one village to a nearby city. You can still pass, you can walk, but you cannot go with your car. You cannot use one car, including people who need medical treatment, including people who go to school, including people, old people, including merchants. All those have to change cars or to walk. So people got used to it. So it started to be the walking people. But then if you have tanks around, the blocks of concrete are a sign that you are not allowed to go from one village to another. So if you have a tank nearby, it makes it, or a jeep, military jeep, it makes this prohibition very clear when it shoots. I've been witnessing myself with my own eyes in several places where people try to leave Nablus, for example, to go back home to a near village after they were in school or shopping for something, and a tank, huge tank, shooting not from the cannon, when I was the witness for this, but from the machine guns on it, on the head of people, over the head of people. There have been cases where people were killed as a clear sign that they were transgressing the prohibition to go, to move from one place to another, because this is what's so-called internal closure. Internal closure means you cannot go from one area to another. Then in also the implementation or the fines against those who were found transgressing the restrictions, this grew with time. If many people managed to violate these regulations in the first phase, gradually police and army would punish them, usually by confiscating the cars. Then Israelis, mostly Israeli Palestinian drivers, were forbidden to have Palestinian passengers in their cars. I'm not allowed to have a Palestinian passenger in my car. So is any Palestinian Israeli who owns a taxi, for example, or relatives in Jerusalem who have people in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, or Palestinians who are citizens of Israel who have relatives in the West Bank, are not allowed to have Palestinian passengers in their Israeli licensed cars driving in this these roads, which I term sometimes very cynically Jewish roads. Then the same thing happened in Gaza. The same process happened in Gaza. Gaza was the first place where people started to need special permits in order to go in or go out of their village. Special permits. And these villages, I mean, it's two agricultural areas in the northern Gaza, Sayafa, it's called Sayafa, and in the middle of Gaza, called Mawasi. And these are the two empty areas still existing, mostly, in the Gaza Strip. And not surprisingly, that's where the Israeli settlements are. So because of the, for the security of the settlers, people who live there are the only ones who are allowed to go in and out, and also with special permits. Anybody who wants to go and visit them needs a special permit, which means, again, waiting for 1 day, 2 days, 1 week, 3 weeks, 4 weeks for a permit to go inside. There are age limitations. People between 12 to 35, men between 12 and 35 cannot go. They need a special permit. Women who are not married and are not pregnant are not allowed to go without a permit. Women above 30, it changes all the time. Anyway, this stratification or this fragmentation of the society deepened and included these people, these special groups in the Gaza Strip. Then in 2002, after the big invasions of April 2002, a new regulation or a new order, military order, was issued, forcing all Palestinians wishing to leave one city and entering to another city. By this time, all the cities are well fenced all around with checkpoints, and not fenced, but all guarded and isolated by checkpoints and by roadblocks. Everybody wishing to go from one city to another, let's say Ramallah to Nablus, needs a special permit. So you have to go to the Israeli military authorities, called the civil administration, to wait and to ask for a permit. This includes merchants and students and teachers, etc. Officially, the Palestinian Authority rejected, said we cannot cooperate or collaborate with such policy, which enforces us to have permit to move in our own territory. But practically, every Palestinian high official needs such permits and asks and gets them, and quite quick, and depending, not as quickly as before, but still more quickly than mortals who have to wait for ages for such permits, if at all. So this seemed like the peak that one can even imagine in such a regime of passes. But now we arrived at a new peak just 3 weeks ago, where the people who live to the west of the West Bank and actually are locked in between the new, what Israel calls, security fence or security wall, which is built, and they are locked in between this fence and the green line. So these people, according to new military orders, need to have a special identity card, which identifies them as the residents on the land, in the house, where they have lived for the last, I don't know how many, tens of years, and their families how many hundreds of years. So they need this permit, but this is not the only new documents that they need. They need also permits, to ask for permits to go, like the same thing that started first in Gaza, to go from this area inside the West Bank, in the area occupied by Israel in 67, in order to leave it, and not for entering Israel, but in order to go to a nearby city, can be 5 kilometers away, 2 kilometers away, or to another village, can be half a kilometer away. They need a special permit for this. And people who need, if they need somebody to come and work in their villages, construction, repairs, the sewage, they don't have sewage system, so they need vents which clear the septic, exactly. So they need to have special permit for those. They need to have special permit if there is an electricity problem. Some villages are not connected to the electricity, so they have a generator, and this runs by diesel. So they need a special permit to bring in the diesel. and so on and so on. Right now, it's only 15,000 people. But as Israel is intending to advance the construction of this fence or wall, more and more people will be included in this category, this new category, which is called permanent resident, but not as opposed to citizen, but as opposed to regular resident of the West Bank. It already means that the Israeli authorities can determine if one is allowed to stay there or not. Because from the few villages that I already checked the case there, already the authorities informed several people that they are not going to get these permits or this new documentation, which means the people, if they want to have to conduct normal life, go to work, see family, go to school, whatever, they have to leave their place, they have to leave their homes and land and move to a nearby Palestinian city or village. When I describe again and again this development or double development, or this last development in the pass system, the natural answer of most Israelis is security. And this is a very serious argument in a time of a series of a phenomenon of suicide bombings and attacks in Israel. But as every Palestinian says, let them build a wall of not 8 meters high, of 20 meters high, and a wall, not a fence, because the wall, as it is, it's along 8 kilometers out of the 140 or 30 which were already built. All the rest is barbed wire, actually 3 fences, and in between 2 ditches, and in between an asphalt road, security road, much better than the roads which are running inside the different villages. So this fence is not along the green line. This fence or wall goes deep into Palestinian territory. This is one thing. The other thing, one cannot talk about this fence and forget that at the same time, there are fences, very similar fences, with very similar regulations of movement or restrictions of freedom of movement over Palestinians around settlements in the West Bank. So the fence is an extension of those fences and regulations around the settlement in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. One cannot also disconnect this fence from the fact that right now, while we are talking, the grid that I was talking about, this great developed grid of roads, continues to be built. I was just 2-3 weeks ago in the north of the West Bank, and I was stupefied to see this huge road connecting between, huge road that, I mean, you can see here in San Francisco. So I could see in San Francisco huge roads, and you see it all of a sudden between orchards and of olive trees, and I found out that this road is connecting Israeli communities, Israeli cities on the west and in Israel proper, with 2 tiny settlements in the north, in the area of Jenin, in the north of the West Bank. Tiny, maybe 200, 300 people live there all together. Now, you cannot separate, you cannot disconnect the fence from the fact of this road, which runs into Israel and back runs into the West Bank, into Palestinian through Palestinian territory to these villages. This means that we have to look at the fence together with all the restrictions, movement restrictions, inside the West Bank. And their main purpose and first purpose is to guarantee the safety of the settlers. Those who use the grid, the very developed grid of Israeli roads and other infrastructure. You cannot separate between the two. That's what it means. One cannot, or these two processes are intertwined. These two processes of the last 10, 12 years, the years of the peace negotiations, the colonization, the accelerated colonization of Palestinian territory, and the introduction and perfection of a pass system. I'll end by suggesting a few reasons to the introduction of this pass system and its development in the course of the last 13 years. I believe that in 91, it's more than I believe, I know. It's a matter of living through and assessing and talking to officials. I admit I don't have access. Nobody yet has access to Israeli official documents relating to the introduction of this pass system. But it was introduced in order to contain possible escalation in the first uprising, the first intifada. Both Israelis and Palestinians came to a sort of a deadlock in 1991. The Palestinian uprising did not succeed as a popular or lost momentum as a popular uprising. And there were all kinds of manifestations of armed resistance, individual or organized, but it didn't catch on the majority of the Palestinian population. At the same time, Israel could not think about repression that then was known, repression of possible uprising or escalated uprising, armed uprising, in the scale that we knew in Lebanon. Because in 91, Israel acknowledged itself as the occupying power. As the occupying power, it was restricted in its and it had the responsibility over the Palestinian civilian population. That's why it could not have such mass repression means and methods as it used in Lebanon and as it uses now in the occupied territories. I'll come to this at the end. So this was the introduction of the closure. It was containing a possible uprising because the Israeli authorities did not intend to reply to the uprising. It was then Likud government. It did not intend to reply to the Palestinian uprising, to the political demands of PLO. It did not intend to accept the two-state solution, as PLO at that time accepted and as most of the world expected or saw fit. So bureaucratic logistic solution was the best in order to contain. By this control over space and time, indeed Israel managed to start and control the population in better ways than just by going into villages, raiding villages, going out, enraging more and more people, etc. Then with the Oslo Agreement, this did not change, but turned into a sort of a negotiation chip in the hands of Israel. It was still under labor. The control over freedom of movement meant control over Palestinian economy, to a great, and also control over the relations between the Palestinian population and the Palestinian Authority, because so much was at stake if you have a permit or if you do not. The closer you are to the Palestinian nomenclatura, the more chances you have to get a permit. So this control over the Palestinian Authority guaranteed for Israel in the time of negotiations over a certain agreement gave Israel better leverage at the negotiation table. This closure policy, and this is also a policy and a measure or a method of control, indeed fragmentized the Palestinian society, and this was again in the hands of Israel. So as I described before, it allowed Israel to even to control the internal relationships between different strata of the society. With time, the closure policy became a way, actually, was a way for Israel to wage an economical war of attrition against the Palestinian Authority. This is the main, maybe, feature of the Oslo years, this economical war of attrition. Israeli governments, all negotiating with the Palestinians, starting with Rabin, through Peres, through Netanyahu and then Barak. With this policy of closure and other, and the Israeli military supremacy, when they withheld withheld the progress of the interim agreement, they hoped and they said so. They hoped and they opted for imposing over the Palestinian an agreement which would be far away from what Palestinians and many peace activists in Israel and members of the UN saw as the right solution. This Israeli supremacy over economy and control over so many aspects of Palestinian life and over Palestinian authority enabled Israel to believe that it was possible to impose finally a solution that would guarantee a weak Palestinian political entity. Weak because it wouldn't have real territorial contiguity. Weak because it would not control water sources. Weak because it would include embittered Palestinian society vis-a-vis the elite and the authority. In December 1999, Palestinian authority was Palestinian negotiator Yasser Abed Rabo was fed up with the ongoing construction of settlements, and he decided to suspend the negotiations on the final status with Israel. It was mostly a kind of declarative act, but still it drew attention to the fact that Israel under Ehud Barak continues to build in the settlements and to expand settlements extensively. Then there was some hoo-ha around it after this, and under this pressure and the pressure of European countries and maybe the US, Barak said that, okay, he will freeze tenders for new constructions in the West Bank. We'll freeze tenders, but for 3 months, he said. He hoped that after 3 months, Israel and the Palestinians will reach some kind of a framework agreement, because he froze all withdrawals which were supposed to be implemented according to the interim agreement. He froze. He didn't redeploy the Israeli army at all. There was a press conference. Albright came then to Israel. We later knew that at that moment she and Barak already knew that Assad, the father, already planned to resume negotiations with Israel. So this was a great present for Barak. But the public didn't know it yet. And in this press conference, most of the questions concentrated on his decision to freeze, or many of the questions, on his decision to freeze the tenders, the issuing of new tenders. And one of the journalists asked him, aren't you surrendering now to Palestinian pressure? Isn't it a sort of giving up to under Palestinian pressure? And Barak was really angry, because he heard the claims of settlers, because the settlers' lobby said the same thing, that he is giving in. And he said, this way, this kind of cheap accusation, what he wanted to say is not see what really I'm doing. Because I know best how I know what is best for the state of Israel in its fight for our hold in the land of Israel. It's even difficult to translate. It's a very special Hebrew language or Hebrew terms. The distinction between the state of Israel, which means the 67 borders, and the land of Israel, which is the greater Israel between the river and the sea. And what he wanted to say, I know best how we can take the state of Israel in its fight, how to assist the state of Israel in its struggle for the land of Israel, which means how to have better grip over more territory in the land of Israel. This is the maybe untold history of the last 13 years. If we don't remember and take into account this double consolidation of Israeli control over Palestinian space and territory and over Palestinian time, I think we cannot really understand the reasons for the current intifada and the bloodshed that is continuing and escalating. Thank you.